This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Hershey Felder, who has a new show. The Piano and Me world premiere is at Theater Works in Mountain View through February 8th. And for more information on that, you could go to theaterworks.org. Hershey Felder has been performing for 28 years, over 6,000 performances, several different shows, starting with one on Gershwin and moving on. I believe I spoke with you about the Rachmaninoff show a couple of years ago. Let me start by asking, why did you decide that this was the right time to tell your own story?
When I left last year and I was asked to perform something new this coming year, I mean, where we are now, they asked, what would I like to do? And I said, well, I have a lot of ideas for stories. And a lot of people said to me, but what about your own story? I said, well, my story is not interesting. Oh, no, you have to tell your own story. Okay, well, tell our story. That's kind of how things happened.
Okay, so there you are, faced with telling your own story. Break it down. How did you come to, without going into detail, because I know you want people to see the show and figure things out when they see the show, but how did you arrange it? Did you have any kind of writer's block there? Did you immediately know where to go and how to put it together?
Well, given that this is my 18th production, which is including films, the technique I use is I answer three questions. The first is, why am I there? Who am I talking to? And what story am I telling? And if you can answer those three questions honestly, then you're able to embark on a story.
Hello.
This is not a story that I had to make up because it's my story. So I was able to tell the truth, and that, I guess, made things easier. I wasn't looking for a story to tell. I knew what it was.
You start with your birth and you continue up to the creation of the first show, Gershwin. In that story, a lot of it deals with your family's past. And I don't want to go into specifics there, but there were refugees coming over from Europe following World War II. It's become commonplace to compare things happening in the world, ICE raids, Gaza, to the experiences of families like yours during World War II. What do you think of those comparisons?
Well, I don't make them because what's happening now is specific to now. What's happening now is heartbreaking. It's just as heartbreaking as before, but I don't think there is a comparison. By that, I mean that each situation lives in its own time. And I think coming here, you know, well, in my case, to Canada, the world was open. It was a floodgates of welcome at that time. And I just tell the story as it is. If it has any reflection to what's happening today, that's out of my hands. You know, I think that when it's a story like this, you just have to be honest about what the story is itself. And as long as you're absolutely honest about that story, it will reflect in various ways to various people. People are making comparisons, but that's not my intention. My intention is to tell the story in its honest form and allow it to resonate however it does.
As you're working on it, I mean, it must have struck you particularly, and I'm not going to go into detail again, particularly in terms of certain words that were used over in Europe. It must have struck you that even though you're consciously avoiding comparisons, something must have been going on in the mind of Hershey Felder.
The only thing that goes on in the mind of Hershey Felder when I'm doing something like that is tell the story. You have to absolutely avoid trying to dig into comparisons and trying to dig into, oh, that sounds like today. Oh, I'm putting that in. I think that's dangerous. I think that's dangerous for any writer because the moment you do that, then I don't think the gilding the lily is the right expression. The moment that you're doing that is that you're buttering the bread on the wrong side. You're trying too hard to make comparisons. It's not a matter of avoidance or acceptance. It's a matter of being true to the story itself. And again, you can only reflect on what is similar to today or not after the story is composed, after it is written, after it plays. Because if you try to do that while you're doing it, you get into a lot of trouble.
I attended your show, The Piano and Me, last night with a friend of mine who's a math teacher in a high school in Menlo Park. And as a teacher, he, of course, I said, you have any questions, ask Hershey Felder. And he immediately came up with some, which I think refers to his own teaching and his own learning. So I'm going to throw that out at you. You talk in the show a lot about learning how to play the piano, a lot about your own struggles playing the piano. He asks, what did you struggle most with in the first year of learning piano?
Struggle is not really the right word, because I never struggled learning to play piano. I struggled to play it well. There's a difference. Playing always came very natural to me. In fact, the biggest problem with my playing early on was that it was very easy. And when things are easy, you tend to skip the details, and the devil is in the details. And it was necessary that I pay a lot of attention. And as I grew up and as time went on, I understood that I had to slow down with my learning, that I had to be more careful and more attentive to very specific and very basic things. Because if I did that, I would be a better artist, a better musician. It just came too naturally. Natural doesn't always mean good or refined or polished. It just was too easy.
It was mainly a question of powering through, do you think, or stopping and starting again?
No, of thinking. You don't just power through without thinking. The most important thing to art and playing and learning is to always engage the mind. The mind must always be engaged in what the goal is and how that goal is meant to be achieved. Because if the mind is not engaged to do that, we've got a problem.
Broaden it a little bit to your career as you went along, even after you began doing the shows. What were the problems that came up in your playing in terms of your practicing, in terms of...
It's about learning economy in practice. It's about learning how to accomplish what you've set out to accomplish without any extraneous ideas or efforts going on. It's about being focused on what you do and how you do it with an ultimate goal. You never power through. You always think through. And you always must use your brain in order to accomplish that what you have in your brain is what's coming out on the other end in terms of the listener. And that's the connection that's very important, is making that connection of those two things to work together. That's a lifetime and a lifelong project. That's not something that just happens, you know. And when you realize you're going off the beaten path and that's not exactly what you need to be doing, you have to rethink how you go about it and refine your approach. It's like anything. Anything good requires constant work and good work.
Which show do you think required you to step most out of your own comfort zone?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I've never not stepped out of my own comfort zone. My own comfort zone would be to sit at home in a bathrobe and read and study. So I think every one of the shows requires me to step out of my own comfort zone. It's required to produce this kind of stuff for the public. People pay good money. You have a responsibility to produce things at the highest level. And none of them are easy. That's the interesting thing, is, oh, this must be easier for you, or that is easier for you. No, anything done well isn't easy. And anything done well requires a tremendous amount of consistent and constant work. Yeah, sure, I'd love to be lazy, but can't afford to.
How much do you practice outside of doing the shows?
Well, you know, the basic practice for any pianist is, you know, a lot of pianists, there's some who play 8 hours a day. They practice a lot and they're really astonishing. But pianists who play in general professionally, you know, 3-4 hours a day, depending on what's going on and what you need to accomplish. It's like that.
When working on this show in particular, when you're rehearsing, are you also then practicing, or you're doing a run through and practicing at a different time of the day?
You have to, because they're two different mechanisms. You have to be ready with your music. So you're, you know, I would rehearse the show during the day. And in general, the way it worked for preparing this one was I would rehearse and study during the day. And then usually about 7 o'clock at night, I'd work from 7 to 11, something like that, to the piano. This is not when I'm doing the show. When I'm doing the show, I'm practicing during the day because the lines are already memorized. But in terms of learning a new play, writing, rewriting, getting it on its feet, that rehearsal takes place during the day. And then I tend to reserve the nighttime for myself to practice. And when it comes to now, I'll take two or three hours. But I'm also preparing another show. It's always something going on. I'll tend to do that for 2 or 3 hours in the day. And then you have the show at night. So I can say I'm probably at the piano 5-6 hours a day, but I'm also at my computer writing and doing all kinds of things the rest of the time.
And you're also at the same time, I guess, either preparing internally how you're going to act in your shows at the same time.
Well, that's not quite the process. That's a constant process that you think about what you're going to do, how you're going to do it. And then you're in front of the audience and you work it and then you think about it later. You know, if you're an artist and you're performing and you're working, there's never a time when you're not thinking about it. Maybe if you fall asleep, even when you fall asleep, but always one must think about it because it's the job. It you know, it's something that's always present. It's part of your being. So you have to do that kind of work constantly.
Is it easier when you're home performing there then?
It's like anything. You figure out how to work your schedule wherever you are. You know, you have creature comforts at home because you have your dog. You have things like that that take care of you. You have your wife, your dog. They help. On the road, I've been doing this for so many years. It's close to 30 years that I'm professionally on stage, maybe 31 years, that it's just part of my system. It's how I work. It doesn't matter where I am. It's whatever bed I wake up in. That's the room I have to work in and prepare and study and write. And then I have to go to the theater. It doesn't matter which theater I'm at. It just matters what I have to accomplish. Do I like being at home with the things that, yeah, but that means I'm not working on the stage. It means I'm preparing something or writing a new script. And there's going to come a point where I'm not going to want to run around and sleep in strange beds and hotel rooms and so on and so forth. That point is going to happen at some point.
When you're up on stage, and I've talked to other theater performers about this, how conscious are you every second of how an audience is responding to you?
You're always conscious of it, because if you're not, then you're not engaged with the audience. You know, when you're doing a play, it's very different because you're engaged with your other artists on the stage and you have a form and a structure. You're not just performing for the audience. This is different because it's a one-man show. The other actors is the audience. They are the people we engage with. They're sitting there and I'm talking to them. So you're conscious of the engagement immediately. You have to be, because you have to be aware of what they're grabbing onto and what they're not. And you're talking to them. And if I learned anything very early on, and I'm a veteran of 6,000 live performances, right, with audiences, millions of people all over the world, what I learned early on is you can't let go of your audience. The moment you go off onto your own and you don't think of them and you're not engaged with them, may as well go home. You're not doing what you need to be doing. But that's for this kind of show. It's very particular. So you must be engaged with them all the time. Conscious and judging of how they're responding, that's different. But engaged with them is important. If you're looking for attention about what you missed and what you got and so on and so forth, more than how it functions within the context of the play, you're not ready to do it. What you have to think about is what you're working on. And it isn't about your own ego or your own self-accomplishment. It's for the larger good, for the greater good. It's not whether I missed it or not. It's whether the story is served by what you're doing. And if the story is not particularly served and you realize that moment didn't work, you don't think, ooh, I didn't get that. You think, how can I, within the context of the story, make this work better at the next performance? And the important thing is to treat each performance as if it's a fresh one. You never want to get up in front of an audience and repeat what you've done the night before. You have to understand how you accomplished what you did the night before, but you have to start completely fresh and free to be able to recreate in front of the audience each time. You're never on autopilot. You're never in a situation where you said, oh, I did that. Okay, I know how to do this. So I'm just going to repeat that and it's fine. It doesn't work that way. You have to be present all the time. And I think the important thing every day is to recognize the need to be present every single time you do it. The public is there for the first time. As I said, they've paid good money. They've dragged themselves from God knows where to get to you. You have a responsibility to be as fresh and as alive each time and connected to them. So there's never, oh, I got it. So that's how I do it. Now I'm just going to run it. It's always something new and present each night.
What are your pre-show actions? How do you set yourself up? What's your preparation like?
I'm never at the theater later than 2 or 3 hours before. I never show up, 15 minutes to the theater and say, oh, throw my costume and, no. I'm always there at least 2 hours, most of the time, quite a bit more. I'm usually at the piano, I'm studying and I'm thinking and just getting ready. And it's quiet time. I don't hang out, and visit and joke with friends. For every now and then, there's an important gathering of some patrons that I'm expected to show up. I'll say hello for a few minutes and go. You need quiet time and you need to think, because to go and do 2 hours in front of an audience and give everything you have, it's important to be ready to think on your feet. And you can't distract yourself with all kinds of things before you're doing that. It's not something you turn on immediately. And God bless people who do that. I don't know how, but, I can't and nor will I. I need to be ready and I need to be in the theater and I need to be engaged with what I'm about to do. It's a big responsibility.
I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about some of the other work you're doing. I went to Hersheyfelder.net and I noticed a lot of shows that are available for people to stream. And it looks like the newest one is something called Musical Tales of the Venetian Jewish Ghetto, and that's a film. When was that done, and what's the story about?
No, it's actually not the newest. There are newer ones, but that's the one that comes up when you see that. That was released in 2023. It's won a bunch of awards. It's been all over the world in lots of festivals. It's a touching piece, not unrelated to the material that you see in Piano and Me in terms of history, but Venice is a place that I know very well because I have a part-time home there. It was interesting to learn that the first ghetto was there in the world. So the first actual ghetto, it happened to have been a Jewish one, but and that was constructed in 1516 on an island in Venice where Jews were essentially locked in at night. And the reason it's called ghetto is because it was the place where it was the foundry, the dispensary for the foundry, not dispensary, but the garbage dump for the foundry. And the dump in Italian is where you throw things, which is gettare, which means to throw away. When the Germans came, the Jewish Germans came, they couldn't pronounce the G. So they called it G hard and it ended up being called ghetto. And that is how ghetto found its name, by this little island in Venice, Italy. I told the story of that with a lot of artists who were around and artists that I know. That was one of the films. I'm now in the middle of production of a piece called Tender Art, which is another film about Chopin, Frédéric Chopin, his story, where I play Chopin and direct the movie. We've already done lots of the interiors. I just have exteriors in Paris and Poland, and that will be out next summer. I'm working on another piece. So it's constant, and the films are a lot of fun. I've got three films this year. I've got another one called The Joe Alterman Project, which is about a very famous jazz musician who's a living musician now, who is really a fascinating artist. And the other is the 60th anniversary of the release of the movie The Sound of Music, a documentary about that, which I'm making and have made with the cast of The Sound of Music, who have been with me, and I've just been with them to Salzburg filming the cast of the movie, who are all very dear friends. So that will be released a little bit later this year also.
You also did a piece on Sondheim. What was that about?
It was an analysis of his compositions. So I think that piece was called A Conversation About Stephen Sondheim. And it was looking through his career about the development of his lyrics and his music as a composer and understanding how that all came to pass and transpired.
Hershey Felder, when you're creating your shows or these films, how often do you get surprised by the research and go, oh, wow, that kind of changes what I was planning to do?
I think just to variate on your question, it doesn't quite change what I was planning to do because I never plan anything without enough knowledge at first. In general, I will go into something having really studied, so I know the general idea of what I want to communicate and that what I want to communicate is already intrinsic to the truth of the story. Then I will tell a story that supports that truth. I won't create something out of whole cloth and then find something and go, oh, I'd rather have done that differently. That would have been easy. No, I really try to go about this by very seriously understanding who I'm dealing with and what story I'm telling before I start telling it. The complication is how to tell that story. And that's where the discovery comes. It's how do you tell the story that you know you want to tell? And that takes, you know, it's a lot of work.
On this particular show, The Piano and Me, you obviously had to hone it down. If you had another half hour, which you don't have, what might have been in the show?
Well, there was another hour of material when I first started reading it aloud. It was over 3 hours. And then you realize that stories become redundant. There are things that you've already said in one way that you don't need to say in another way. You think you do originally because you think, well, maybe it's not in there. And then you realize you're getting your point across with one particular story. You don't need two of them or three of them, as the case may be. It's about advancing. In this case, particularly, yes, it advances what happened, sure. But it also has to advance an idea. And if I realize in certain places that, oh, I've already shared that idea, I don't need to advance that idea again. They've got it. So that's where you can really tailor what you have to say to advance the idea and the point that you're making. Of course, you know, life is built up of so many things. But in order to create an essence of what that life is, you have to choose the very particular and very best things that will advance the idea and the story, and anything else is either redundant or not necessary.
I noticed in this show you play Rhapsody in Blue, and you tell the story of some of the details you had early on. Rhapsody in Blue is now, I believe, in public domain. Is that correct?
Indeed it is. It was in public domain in 2024, which was 100 years after it was composed. And of course, George Gershwin died in 1937. So after 75 years, it was 2024, if I'm not mistaken, that it became in the public domain, but it is in fact in the public domain.
Which makes it easy to put your show together, but you can't quite get to An American in Paris because I believe that was 1927.
Well, I don't know. It might be. I think all George Gershwin's works are now in the public domain that are not related to anyone else. However, the Gershwin family very cleverly associated George Gershwin's works that he wrote with his brother as joint works. That means it's 75 years from the death of Ira that they go into the public domain and not 75 years from the death of George, which was a very clever and wise way to go about maintaining for the George side of things royalties beyond the 75 years beyond George's death.
When you're doing these shows, are you thinking about younger people attending? Are you thinking in some ways about kind of extending a little bit of what Bernstein did in the 50s?
No, what I just do is tell a good story, and I hope that it appeals to younger people. And from what I'm seeing in audiences, in particular matinees and weekends, is that because, you know, during the week, kids go to school, you know, so their parents are not likely to take them out in the middle of the week to go and see a show. But on weekends, we're starting to see Well, I've always seen this with all my shows, lots of kids who play the piano, seeing that a lot on weekends, a lot. It's always been that way. I always believe that the best way to teach young people is to treat them like they're very smart adults, not to pander to, I don't know, lesser capacity to understand, or not, that's not true because you don't want to pander to that, but don't assume that they're not as bright as their parents. And they are. They're very wise, very smart. Kids are very, very astute. They understand and see everything, especially today. So I don't think of it in those terms. What I do think about is making it available to them in terms of price points, in terms of lots of donor events, which I do a lot of, lots of masterclass teaching, which I'm known for, all gratis. I don't ever charge any money for teaching or for hosting things for kids. I think that's important. Do I think of it as a Leonard Bernstein thing? No, I think he had his thing. This is my thing.
Hershey Felder, there are cooking videos. Are you kind of a master chef?
I'm not at all a master chef. I'm somebody who loves to cook, and somebody who loves to be able to cook for people. And over the years, I've learned how to do that. Some things come out really wonderfully, and other things lay a rotten egg. So, you know, you have to, it's a trial and error situation. I am by no means a master chef whatsoever, but I'm adept in the kitchen. I can get around the kitchen and I can prepare for lots of people, which I have. And I think even people in Mountain View or in these parts in the Bay Area have experienced some of my donor dinners where I get to be the one to cook and theaters raise funds with my cooking and hopefully not killing anybody. It's a fun thing to do.
Hershey Felder, during the pandemic, you went out of your way to help theater companies survive during a very difficult time. What do you see as the future of live theater? Because in the Bay Area, there are real problems.
I think there are real problems everywhere, but I don't think the real problems are with theater per se as much as it is just the world is finding its way. People will always want theater. They'll always want to be entertained. They'll always want to be in a situation where they can engage live. Selling theater is hard. It's different. You know, you have to think about the various ways of how you want to communicate with people. You also have to be practical. It has to be financially possible to do it. I've always, in my teaching, I say to young artists, don't create something that will require $100 million in investment to make a movie that you're fantasizing about being the biggest billionaire for the next Marvel Studios, whatever thing. Look around you. Look what's in your university. Look what's in your school. See what props you have. See what spaces you have and figure out how to tell a story and figure out how to bring those people in there. If you do that, you're already dealing with things that are there and that are real. Be practical. Use what you have in order to tell your stories and people will come. And I've proven it. It works. I've set up a situation where over years, audiences know and trust the stories that I'm telling. So yes, I get an audience, but I started very practically. Very practically with what I had. I had an instrument. I had 10 fingers. I had a story first in somebody's basement, and then a little bit more people want to come and you begin to open up. But don't create something that is so impossible to actually put on its feet or to have to raise so many millions of dollars that if you don't. Now, there are people who have done that, you know, Hamilton and all these kinds of things. Sure. But if you want to be a working artist, try and do something first that's practical, that you can actually get your hands on, so that you can perform for the audience, that you can engage people. And if you do that, you can find ways slowly to up your ante each time. I don't think theater is going to, that's the old Isaac Bashevis quote about Yiddish. If Yiddish is dying, it should die this way another 1,000 years. I say the same thing about theater. If theater is dying, it should die another 1,000 years. Now, yes, it's being faced with huge challenges financially, all kinds of things. Well, one must adapt. And I think adapting is the secret, understanding what the audience wants to see, where they want to see it, how they want to see it, and how you're going to engage people. And I think if we do that, we can somehow maintain it alive. There's no easy answer. There's no easy answer, and there's no easy way to do it. It is difficult, but I think we can't stop trying and figuring out ways. And not expecting outcomes, but looking at what the outcome is and seeing how we can build on an outcome that is successful. And I think that's the secret.
You've been listening to an interview with Hershey Felder. His show, The Piano and Me, world premiere, is at TheaterWorks in Mountain View through February 8th. And for more information on that, you could go to theaterworks.org. Hershey Felder's website is hersheyfelder.net. And there you can stream several shows.
Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.